starting a new series today called Without a Doubt. It's based on the teachings of the founder Acharya of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Petrarch, ancient historian, said, "The beginning of doubt, the end of doubt, is the beginning of repose." How do you know that you're going to go to Krishna's kingdom after death? You think so, you hope so, you guess so, you want to go. Hoping and guessing are not going to cut it. 90% of Americans who believe in a spiritual world or an afterlife, when they're asked if they believe they're going to get there, say they are. But when they're asked whether they're sure they're going to get there, or whether they're going to get there without a doubt, they come up with these sort of qualifying phrases. Think so, hope so, guess so. I'd sure like to go. Sure, it would be nice there. But if you really press them, they cannot be 100% sure that they're going to get there, in fact. Is everything fine with everybody's life, that everybody's going to go to heaven? Because if everybody thinks they're going to go to heaven, then we must be in pretty good shape, right? But if you scratch the surface and you look a little bit below the surface, you'll see that there's a deep disquietude. There's really very, very serious doubts on the part of just about everybody, in fact, as to whether they're doing what it takes to transcend and get to that world without end. We go to a funeral, we see a friend of ours who's died, and we wonder, did he get there? Did he get there? We're waiting for our tests back from the doctor. We're scared that he might come back with the diagnosis of the big C. And so we think more deeply and harder about where we're going after life than we normally do. And we have to ask ourselves the hard question. Are we sure that we're going to get there? We glance in the mirror and we see the crow's feet and we feel the aches and the pains. We feel our own mortality. And in the face of this evidence of our growing decrepitude, and we ask ourselves the question, are we sure we're going to get there without a doubt? And we can't say that, in fact, we are. Have you ever visited a grandmother of yours? She's in her 90s. She probably hasn't much got time left on this planet. And you want to poll her. You want to ask her, what is her opinion, what is her certitude about where she's going after she's leaving this body? So you go to your grandma. Now, she's lived a long life, a law-abiding life, a righteous life. She's followed all the laws of the land. She's paid her taxes. She's gone to church every Sunday for the last 50 years without missing. She nursed her dying husband through the many, many last years. She raised children to be good and upright and honest community members. She paid all her speeding tickets. She does community work. She does work for charity. And you ask her, Grandma, when you die, are you sure you're going to go to heaven? What's she going to say? I sure hope so, honey. So are you going to face eternity with nothing better than I sure hope so, honey? And then this is a person who's probably a lot more moral than we are. This is a person who's probably got a lot more character and a lot more moral fiber than we are. And she's facing eternity with nothing better than I sure hope so, honey. So we might want to have something a little more firm to stand on, a little less doubt. Even the really good people only hope that they're going to go to heaven. And that's an untested assumption. How many of you go to bed at night with that little thing in the wall there? You've been told that if there's some carbon dioxide, if there's some smoke escape, that will set off an alarm, it will wake you and save your life, and that you will be able to exit the house. Now, have you tested it? Have you gone in there? Have you looked to see? This can't go on. Have you tested it? Have you looked to see what's in there? For all you know, it might be filled with pizza. NYPD. Or it might be filled with foam. But yet you go to sleep soundly at night, confident that will save your life should there be a fire. Now, you're basing your comfort and your security and your sound sleep on an untested assumption. So it is an untested assumption that after this life, we're going to go to heaven. Only a fool does not prepare for that which is inevitable. Only a fool does not prepare for that which is inevitable. Krishna doesn't want us to reach the end of our lives full of doubt, full of worry, and full of fear. In the Bhagavad Gita, he encourages us, Maya Sakta Manaparta Yogam Yungam Marasraya Asam Sam Samagramam Yata Jignashasi Tachnu. He doesn't want us to doubt. He wants us to be full of certitude, confidence, and free from doubt. And so he encourages Arjuna with this verse in the Bhagavad Gita. Now hear, O son of Prita, how by practicing yoga in full consciousness of me, with mind attached to me, you can know me in full, free from doubt. This is what God wants for you. He doesn't want you to be not sure. He doesn't want you to be full of hallelujahs and hosannas and I believe and I believe and I believe. At the same time, all that is braggadocio, covering up a very, very deep lack of certainty. Mahatma Gandhi said of that same Bhagavad Gita that we just quoted, when doubts haunt me, when disappointments stare me in the face and I see not one ray of hope on the horizon, I turn to the Bhagavad Gita and I immediately begin to smile in the midst of overwhelming sorrow. He furthermore said, those who meditate on the Gita will find fresh joy and new messages from it every day. The Gita is a manual how to make the transition from this life to the next life successfully. And it further says, Ante kale chamam eva. This is a clock. The illustration is a clock. Kale means clock. Ante means when it stops. When the clock stops ticking. When the heart stops beating. That's when the test will come how we have lived our lives. Just like in school, at the time of examinations, it will be seen how good your study habits were and how conscientious you were. Similarly, ante kale, when the last heartbeat comes, when the sands run out of the hourglass of our lifespan, that's when we're going to be tested. And Krishna, God, our loving Father, wants all of us to pass that test. And how do we do it? His advice is this. Remember me, attain me, and go to my nature. There's no doubt of this. Those who think of God at the time of death go to God. Those who fail to think of God at the time of death, there's no magic pass, there's no Tinkerbell dust, there's no magic wand. Your thoughts carry you to your next destination. In the Bhagavad Gita it says that just as air carries aromas, similarly, the soul is carried to another body at the time of death. So whatever your consciousness is, however you've lived your life, whatever choices you've made, those have created a certain type of mentality. The books you read create a certain type of consciousness. The people that you associate with create a certain type of consciousness. The food that you eat creates a certain type of consciousness. And that consciousness will carry the soul to a suitable body at the time of death. Just like the air carries aromas. From a garbage pit, the air is carrying a pungent, unpleasant aroma. From a rose garden, the air is carrying a very, very beautiful, flavorful aroma. So each one of us is carrying, so to speak, a certain aroma around with us, and that aroma will determine where we go at the end of life. And Krishna says, those who have the aroma, who have the flavor, who have the fragrance of me, who think about me, associate with other devotees, worship in the temple, eat food that's only offered to me, listen to talks and lectures about me, discuss my philosophy, those will go to me. And what's the difference? What's the advantage of going to Krishna? Krishna says, those who come to me never return to this world of birth and death. They never return to this world of birth and death. Now in India, there's a process called Karmakanda. It's a philanthropic, altruistic process of doing good to others. Because people understand the law of karma. They know that if you give a dollar to a beggar, you'll get $100 back in your next life. If you give a dollar to a saintly person engaged in the propagation of God consciousness or building a temple or a lecture, then you'll get $1,000 back in your next life. Any pious charitable works for a temple result will get you a result in your next life. But even going to the heavenly planets, even ascending to a higher place within this material world, it's explained in the Bhagavad Gita, they come back. They come back from there, having expended the results of their pious activities. But Krishna says, those who go to my abode, they never come back, who are thinking of Krishna at the time of death. And one such example from the great epic, the Mahabharata, was Bhishma Dev. Bhishma Dev was a great warrior who was also Krishna conscious. His body, during the 10th day of the Kurukshetra War, was perforated through and through with arrows, and he was in fact lying on a bed of arrows, waiting to leave his body. So his request was that, Krishna, you please remember all that I've done for you in this life. You remember the sacrifices I've performed. You remember the Gita passages that I've discussed. You remember the prasadam that I've taken. You remember the devotees of yours that I've protected and patronized and sheltered. And if I have done anything for you during this life, you please grant me this one request, that you appear before me at the time of leaving my body. And look at the image there. You see, right in the center, Krishna. You see Krishna right in the center, personally attending Bhishma at the time of his death. It is said that our goal in Krishna consciousness is not to attain Krishna. Our goal is not to attain Krishna. That Krishna is unattainable. Even yogis and transcendentalists and philosophers, they can't attain Krishna after performing austerities and study the scriptures for lifetime after life. So we don't bother. We don't try to attain Krishna. Our goal is to attain love of Krishna. Attaining Krishna is not within our power. I can't even attain the President of the United States. I can't get to see him, no matter what I do. Chances are very slim. How I'm going to attain the Lord of all the material and spiritual universes? How I'm going to do that? So our goal is not to attain Krishna. It's out of our control. It's beyond our abilities to attain God. But it is within our control to cultivate love of God with the help of the scriptures, the association of devotees, and the purificatory effect of consecrated food offered to the Lord. That is entirely within our ability. To try to cultivate love of that person from whom everyone comes. You love a beautiful girl, it comes from Krishna. You actually love Krishna. Try to love the source rather than the byproduct. You love knowledge, Krishna is the goal, the object, the source of all knowledge. You like wealth, you're attracted by wealth and opulence and nice things. Krishna created everything, and so nobody is more wealthy than Krishna. Just try to become attracted to the source of everything, rather than the fragmental piecemeal energies of the Lord. So Bhishma said to the Lord, he said, my dear Lord, I have lived my life in such a way as to be in love with you. I have carried love of you with me as part and parcel of my consciousness. Now Bhishma knows a great secret about God, that God cannot resist the association of those who love him. That aroma attracts the Lord, just like you might like gardenias. Or I remember when I went to the University of Virginia, that was built by Thomas Jefferson, a lot of jasmines. They had these special serpentine brick walls that were designed by Jefferson, and then they're covered with jasmine. And so I used to go out of my way. There'd be a shorter way to get from building A to building B, but I'd go the longer way just so I could go by the jasmines, being attracted by that fragrance. So the Lord, out of billions and billions of living entities, and each one of them is busy with their business of raising their family or getting their education, getting their PhD, doing the commute and putting money in the 401 and the Daisy May and all like that. He'll sniff, he'll detect that one who is saturated with love of the Lord. And he'll come there and he'll sit in the association of that devotee or those devotees. So this is the bait. When you're fishing, it's an axiomatic principle that you don't bait the hook with what you like. You bait the hook with what the fish likes. We were having a debate. We got some clothes imported from India, and my wife thinks we paid too much for them. And so we had a debate here that she has to charge more for them because she thinks I paid too much for them. But I was trying to get the point across. You don't price the clothes according to what you paid for them. You price the clothes according to what people are willing to buy them for. So similarly, you don't bait the hook with what you like. You bait the hook with what the fish likes. So Krishna is attracted to nothing more than love, pure devotional love. And it's the bait by which the Supreme Personality of Godhead is actually captured. He's captured. It says, Yata tishtami vaikunte yoginam ridayashu. It says, the Lord, and this is the Lord, His own statement, He says, I do not live in Vaikuntha. God is saying, I do not live in the spiritual world. I do not live in the spiritual world. Yoginam ridayashu. I am not to be found in the hearts of the yogis. Not in the spiritual world, it's not in the heart of the yogi. So where is he? He says, Yata tishtanti madgata. I go and I sit wherever the devotees are singing my glories. I cannot resist that. I cannot resist that. So Bhisma said, I have this consciousness and I wish that you please accompany me at the time of death. And the Lord said, You didn't even have to ask me. It was already resolved within my mind that I would be with you at the time of leaving your body. And at the time of leaving his body, Bhisma was able to fix his eyes on the lotus face of Lord Krishna and go to him shortly thereafter. In the course of the Bhagavad Gita is all about doubt. It starts because Arjuna has a doubt. The 700 verses of the Bhagavad Gita are Krishna's refutation. Krishna is trying to relieve Arjuna of doubt and fear and confusion. And when the doubt becomes manifest in Arjuna's mind, the first thing he asks Krishna to do is to place the chariot. Krishna is Arjuna's chariot driver. God is the chariot driver of his devotee. That's another story. And Arjuna asks, please place my chariot between the two armies so that I may see with whom I have to fight. There are Arjuna's teachers and cousins and friends on the opposite party, on the opposite side. So Arjuna has doubt. He has doubt whether this, in fact, is the right course of action, to go ahead and fight. And on behalf of all of us, he's expressing basically doubt about Krishna's role as the guide and the leader and the orchestrator of this scenario. And so in order that doubt may be dispelled from our hearts, Arjuna asks Krishna or puts himself in a situation where Krishna is going to have to deal with his doubts. And at the same time, anyone who reads the Bhagavad Gita in the ensuing centuries will also have their doubts dealt with by Lord Krishna. So Arjuna says, please place my chariot between the two armies so that I may see who is present here, who is desirous of fighting. When you get doubts, and what do doubts do? They demand you. They emasculate you. They paralyze you. They confuse you. They fog up your memory. They sully your purity of thought and resolution. When you get doubts, the thing is to go back to basics. John Wooten, the great UCLA basketball coach, the first day of practice, whenever he would have a new team and he would be starting off to train for a whole new season, the first day of practice was devoted to teaching the players how to put their socks on. Because, I mean, it stands to reason. If you don't put your socks on right, how are you going to play well? So his first thing is teach them. He had one after another, after another, after another, championship basketball teams, ruled the whole basketball world for decades and decades, and he started how to put your socks on. Vince Lombardi also, I think Green Bay Packers, first day of practice, says, guys, this is a football. This is a football. So what does Krishna do when Arjuna is confused? He says, Arjuna, you are not that body. He conveys to him the most basic ABCD principle of spiritual life. You are not that body. We may be black or white or Christian or male or female, but that just describes the outer covering. You might have driven here in a Volkswagen or a Pontiac, but you don't introduce yourself as Miss Volkswagen or Mr. Pontiac because you're the person within the car. You're not the car. Similarly, we're not the body. We're the person within the body. And Arjuna's confusion arises from the fact that he has a bodily connection with Duryodhana and Ashwatthama and Dronacharya and Bhisma and all the other warriors. The first point is, put on your socks. This is a football. You're not that body. Aham Brahmasmi. So many problems, so many tensions, so many anxieties, so many sleepless nights would all be resolved if we just realized this basic truth. I'm not this body. I'm not temporal. I'm not flesh and blood. I am eternal. The body may die. Just as it took birth, it will also die. That's a foregone conclusion. But I will never die. I am eternal. Certainly that's got to be a relief to a lot of people to know that we're eternal. But then the next question that arises is, if I'm eternal and I always exist, then how will I exist? How will I exist? Obviously, we've fallen from our eternal position. How can we reconstitute ourselves in that kingdom of God and do it without doubt? Francis Bacon says, in contemplation, if a man begins with certainties, he shall end in doubts. But if he be content to begin with doubts, he shall end in certainties. So here is Arjuna. He's beginning with doubts, and he will end in certainties. At the end of the Bhagavad Gita, he says, Nashta moha smritir labdham, tat prasaram stito smin gata san karishya se vachanam tava. Now my doubts have all dissipated. I am firmly fixed and prepared to act according to your instructions. But if a man begins with certainties, then he will certainly end with doubts. Here in a Back to Godhead article written in the 70s by Hayagriva, it's quoted, in this age especially, one is inclined to disbelieve and doubt, to doubt scripture, to doubt God, to doubt oneself. This age is called Kali Yuga and is characterized by strife, doubt, ignorance, chaos, as well as disagreement. So at the onset of one's spiritual life, needless to say, innumerable doubts will present themselves. There's nothing wrong in having doubts. That's natural. Doubts are a sign of intelligence. They're a sign of intelligence. It's an important function of intelligence. Blind acceptance is not a sign of very intelligence. Krishna refers to Arjuna as Savyasachin. That means in Sanskrit, who defeats the enemies. So right now, Arjuna's enemy is doubt. It is doubt which is keeping him from doing his duty and saving the world for pious and righteous people. So Krishna is confident that Arjuna is going to conquer this enemy as he has conquered all other enemies. He's going to conquer the enemy of doubt because he's intelligent, number one. And number two, he's putting his doubts to the supreme authority, Krishna. See, if you're not intelligent, you're not going to dissolve your doubts. If you're intelligent, but you go to the wrong authority, you're not going to dissolve your doubts. One time we were doing a festival in 1980. One of the ways that we got some funds for getting some property in Utah was I was doing a Festival of India program throughout Southern California in 1980-82. So we were on the campus of Cal State Fullerton. We had exhibits and tents and a stage. And one Indian man came up to me, and we were standing in front of the exhibits. And he said, I have read so much. I have read so much. So many Gitas, so many commentaries, so many authors, so many books. Practically, I've dedicated the last 30 years of my life to reading about Krishna and Gita and so-and-so. And I have to tell you, I have doubts. I have doubts. So I said, well, who have you been reading? Krishnamurti, Vivekananda, Ramakrishna, Nikhilananda, and he rattled off so many who are not devotees of Krishna. So many who, rather than taking the Bhagavad Gita as the ultimate dispeller of doubts from the Supreme Personality of God, if you've got a conversation in which the Lord of the universe is trying to dispel the doubts of his best friend, and then you interpose your own commentary on that, what have you done? You've just basically covered the sun. You've covered the sun. So many so-called spiritual books and translations of the Bhagavad Gita take one away from the message of Krishna. The message of Krishna is meant to dispel doubts. And this man, he's read so many commentaries on the Bhagavad Gita, and he's got doubts after 40 years. That means it's not Krishna's Gita that he's reading. It's not the Bhagavad Gita as it is. It's the Bhagavad Gita as someone would like it. Dr. Radhakrishna, who was once the vice president of India, he wrote his commentary on the Bhagavad Gita. And when it came to the verse, practically the concluding verse, this is the point to which the Gita comes. This is the culmination point. This is the last fell stroke. And that if Arjuna gets this, then he's free from doubt, he's free from confusion. And the verse is this: Manmana bhava madbhakti madyagi mam namaskaru mam evasisi satyam te pratijane priyosime. So you may not be a Sanskrit scholar, but I think you're catching first person singular coming up about six or eight times in that verse. Manmana bhava mad me Baba Madbhakta Madhyagi Mam Namaskaru Mami Vasisi Pratijane Priyosime. 6 times Krishna is standing right in front of Arjuna, and he's telling him, as basically the conclusion of the Bhagavad, if you want to be free from doubt, you want to be firm and fixed in purpose, then you have to think of me, Manmana, Bhava Madbhakta, become my devotee, Madhyagi, worship me, Mam Namaskuru, offer your obeisances to me, Pratijane Priyoshime, thus you will become very dear to me and you will come to me at the time of death. Now, our celebrated commentary, Dr. Radhakrishna comment, says it is not to the personal Krishna that you should think. It is not to the personal Krishna that you should become a devotee. It is not to the personal Krishna that you should worship. It is not to the personal Krishna that you should offer your obeisances. And it is not to the personal Krishna that you'll go in the end of life. So there's no authority, there's no accountability, there's no supreme person, and Krishna's message is totally diverted. So I said, you want to get rid of your doubts, then you read the message of Krishna. Because that message is specifically tailored to remove doubts. Don't read the Gita as it is perverted by someone who has their own agenda. There's one clear message of the Gita, that Krishna is the supreme and we need to surrender to him. Find out what it is that we're put here to do for him. Otherwise, doubt is very, very sign of good intelligence. Now, we're in an age, Kali Yuga, an age of skepticism. We're in an age of doubt. People have already decided they're professional doubters. They don't go around looking with intelligent questions and queries for a high authority, an ultimate authority to dispel their doubts. It's fashionable. It's chic to be a doubter. It's cool to be a doubter. It's cool to be a skeptic. So we're in an age of doubt and skepticism. We're in the age of Kali Yuga. And in the scriptures it says doubt and fear are interrelated. They're the sons of ignorance. I'll repeat that. Doubt and fear are the sons of ignorance. And they live in darkness. They live in darkness. Knowledge is the sunshine. Arjuna had doubt, and the doubt is represented by darkness. And that was a sign of intelligence. And that was good that he started with doubts. But he availed himself of the sunshine of Krishna to dispel the doubts. He didn't turn his back when the sun is there. He says, oh, I'm so attached to my doubts. I'm so attached to the darkness. I think I'll just turn my back and hold on to the darkness here. His response was to open himself up to Krishna's advice and knowledge. Here's a typical phrase here. God doesn't exist because we doubt it. God doesn't exist because we doubt it. And in another article, Back to Godhead, we have this quote. The mood of challenge divorces the defiant soul from any entrance into truth, for the truth stands aloof from challenge or doubt. The sublime and uncomplicated means of success is simply to flood the self with the companionship of the truth, thus annihilating the darkness of ignorance, which is fraught with the agonized writhings of the faithless mind. The prime qualification is to hear conscientiously. Go back to that initial verse. Mad samsam samagram tachnu. Krishna says the tried and true method for removing your doubts is to hear submissively. But not just from any man on the street. Not just from any television commentator. But to hear from that person who created everything. Tachnu, to hear from me submissively, or from his bona fide representative. When Prabhupada, our spiritual master, was a younger man, every year his guru, Bhaktisiddhanta, would have a parikram in Vrindavan. And his disciples would come from all over India. Bhaktisiddhanta had established 64 temples all over India. It had thousands and thousands of disciples. So all those disciples would meet once a year in Vrindavan, the holy place of Krishna's pastimes. And Bhaktisiddhanta would give discourses, and then they would go out and visit some of the holy places of Krishna's pastimes. So on one particular day, Bhaktisiddhanta was going to give an extra discourse. He'd given one discourse. He was going to give another discourse on some special subject matter, and yet there was an excursion planned by bus to one of the holy places. So every one of his disciples had the option of taking the bus and viewing a holy ghat or a holy temple, or staying back and hearing Bhaktisiddhanta, a second lecture of the day by Bhaktisiddhanta. So the vast majority of his disciples went on the bus, or went walking, or however conveyance they did, to the holy place. But Prabhupada stayed and listened to the lecture of Bhaktisiddhanta. And at that time, Bhaktisiddhanta blessed Prabhupada. Prabhupada is the one amongst all those disciples who was empowered by Krishna and by his guru to spread Krishna consciousness all over. Otherwise, all those disciples, they doubted. They doubted that the Westerners could become Krishna consciousness. They doubted that Krishna was in the heart of every living being. They doubted that they could be successful by going to the Western countries. But Prabhupada alone was blessed by his Guru Maharaj, who said at the end of the lecture, "This boy is very nice because he hears. He hears." Hearing is the key to understanding, and hearing is the way to defeat the enemy called doubt. And hearing from the correct sources. It is said that hearing from unbona fide, undevoted personalities, politicians, or scholars, it is first of all like trying to understand the taste of honey by licking the outside of the jar. You cannot understand the taste of honey by licking the outside of the jar. So hearing about Krishna or about Bhagavad Gita from politicians or academicians or businessmen is like trying to understand the taste of honey by licking the outside of the jar. It is also compared to drinking milk touched by the lips of a serpent. Certainly milk is very nourishing, it's very wholesome, it's very nutritional. However, if it has been touched by the lips of a serpent, then that same milk has poisonous effects. So one should hear from the pure devotees. I was giving a talk on Friday night up in Salt Lake City, and one man said, "This, you make a convincing case. You make a convincing case. I believe that if I follow these instructions of Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, that the things that you're promising will actually come true. But it seems so hard, so difficult, so unattainable from where I am now." And I said, "Well, what did you think? You know, that becoming immortal, going to the kingdom of God was going to be easy? I mean, aren't things that are worth having worth some sort of expenditure of effort, and to the degree that they're valuable, then to that degree, isn't it worth to make an investiture of energy?" I said, one of the principal practices of our Krishna conscious movement is chanting Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Just by doing that one thing, you've used your lips to say the name of the Lord, you've used your ears to hear the Lord's holy name, and as a result of chanting Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, you will remember the Lord throughout the day. Shravanam Kirtanam Vishnu Smaranam, hearing and chanting and remembering the Lord. That's the inevitable result of what we call japa, the practice of japa. So here it is said that those who are doubters, those who are more attached to the idea of Krishna or the idea of renunciation or the idea of nonviolence, they can never open themselves up and fully experience the light of Krishna consciousness. Prabhupada says, "They are only scientists and they know nothing of the transcendental spiritual realms that compose three-fourths of the creation. Because they are recalcitrant children of darkness, they have been confined to material nature, and their attempts to break out of it through super drugs and sputniks will always prove futile, because their scientific methodology based on doubt and empiricism will continue to drag them back to the material world." Understanding the super intelligence, and we'll just finish up here with various ways of acquiring knowledge. There are three ways according to our Vedic system of acquiring knowledge. One is called Prajaksha Praman, direct sense perception. The other is Anumana Praman, theories based on evidence. And the last one is Sabda Praman, hearing from a bona fide authority. You see the scientists up here undergoing the process of direct sense perception, where he has to use trial and error. He has to perceive it with his senses before he acknowledges the veracity of it. But there are problems with this. Are you seeing a left-handed man or a right-handed man up there? In one frame, he looks like he's left-handed. But in the other frame, he's right-handed. What's that all about? Well, that's what it happens when you look at a person in the mirror. In the mirror, left-handed becomes right-handed, right-handed becomes left-handed. The straw, is the straw bent or not? It looks like it's bent, right? But actually it's not bent. It's just a reflection of the straw on the water. So is seeing believing? If you are an empiricist and said, I only believe it if I see it, then you must believe that the straw is bent. You must believe that the man is left-handed. And yet that is not the truth. Seeing is not believing. Direct sense perception is eminently limited, and it's also misleading. There are things that we believe that we don't see. How many of you acknowledge that you have a mind? I think all of you would. But have you ever seen your mind? Have you ever seen your mind? We know about wind. We know wind is out there, but we've never seen wind. So there's things that we've never seen that we believe. And there's things that we see which we should not believe as well. And those kinds of relative truths are always changing. And anyway, Krishna or God is called Adukshaja. That means who is beyond the ability of our senses to perceive. We have material senses. We have material coverings, earth, air, fire, water. We perceive the world through imperfect eyes and nose and ears and smell. We have imperfect senses. We have a tendency to make mistakes. We have an inclination to cheat, and we're also subject to illusion. Every embodied soul suffers from these impediments to achieving perfect knowledge. So much for pratyaksha praman. Anumana praman are theories based on evidence. You have a hypothesis based on a little kernel of knowledge, and then you extrapolate. You make it up as you go along. Based on what we know, we're making theories about what we don't know. And here's Darwin's theory on how the bear evolved into a monstrous whale. Tell me if this isn't a stretch, if I can read it. The print's pretty small. In North America, the black bear was seen swimming for hours with wide open mouth, thus catching like a whale insects in the water. Even in so extreme a case as this, if the supply of insects were constant, and if better adapted competition did not already exist in the country, I can see no difference in a race of bears by natural difficulty in a race of bears by natural selection, more and more aquatic in their structure and habits, with larger and larger mouths, till a creature was produced as monstrous as a whale. Thank you very much, Charles Darwin. Thank you very much. Even Charles Darwin, when it came to the eye. You see, evolution, so-called evolution, doesn't take place one step at a time. One step versus one step. Something like the eye, it all has to happen simultaneously. It all has to happen simultaneously for something as complicated and as miraculous as an eye to work. Not that one thing happens and mutates and builds on another. Unless all the features that make the eye converge at the same point in time, you're not going to have an eye. And he's talking about the chance that all those many, many innumerable different factors would all converge at the same point in time to create one eye. It's impossible. The chances of one eye being created by chance are greater than the age of the universe itself. And not only has God produced one eye, but he's produced millions and millions of eyes since time immemorial. So even Darwin said to suppose that the eye could have been formed by evolution seems, I freely confess, absurd in the highest degree. And evolution is further refuted by the record of the rocks. If, as evolution says, man is preceded from the ape, how come there are Neanderthal-like people walking the streets of New York City right now? We're supposed to have superseded them a long time ago, but they're still walking in the streets of New York City. And how come, according to the record of the rocks, and you look at this, one of the oldest men, one of the oldest fossil records, looks quite sophisticated, quite handsome, and quite modern, and he's right there along the same time period as these more primitive people. So it appears that whatever point in history that you choose, there are primitive-looking people, and there are civilized, advanced-looking people living side by side. There's no real record of the rocks that proves that we are evolving from lower to higher, from the monkeys to the human beings. Now, we come to the last way of acquiring knowledge, and I'll just finish this, and we'll continue next week. The last way of acquiring knowledge, first was direct perception, the second was to make theories about what we don't know on the basis of what we know. The last is called Sabdamarman, and it means hearing from a bona fide authority. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, if you want perfect knowledge, if you want knowledge without doubt, get the knowledge from the source. Get the original idea from the original person. And the mechanism for doing that is called parampara, or disciplic succession. Lord Krishna explains that in the beginning of creation, he spoke the Bhagavad Gita to Vivashwan, the sun god. Vivashwan passed it down to Manu, the progenitor of mankind. Manu passes down to Ikshvaku, and in this way, evam parampara praptim imam rijarsya vidu. The transcendental knowledge comes down, it originates with God, and the mechanism, it comes down through a bona fide chain of disciplic succession. And each link in that chain is a pure devotee of Krishna. Someone sold out part and parcel to the Lord with no other agenda in mind. Prabhupada said when he came to the West and so many young people became devotees of Krishna, so many young people gave their lives, their wealth, their energy, their duration of life to serve Krishna 24 hours a day. Why did that not happen when even before Prabhupada came here, there were over 700 editions of the Bhagavad Gita? Why did no one become a devotee of Krishna? Why did no one get the dispellation of their doubts in terms of Krishna consciousness? It is because only Prabhupada delivered the message of Krishna as it is. He said, if I have any credit, it is that I did not add or subtract, like the postman. Postman delivers the letter. He doesn't open it up and rewrite it. Oh, I'll subtract this, I'll add. He just delivers it as it was written. So Prabhupada, as a bona fide representative of the age-old disciplic, just delivers the message of Krishna. And that's why there came to be what has become known as the Hare Krishna explosion now, with 400 temples all over the world. Krishna speaks, he's Jagat Guru. He's the repository of perfect knowledge. He imparts to Brahma, the Lord of the universe, Brahma to Narada, and through the ages, through Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and then down to Sri A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Otherwise, how we understand even this phenomenal world, Isaac Newton, one of the greatest scientists of all time, he said, are all of modern scientists, we're just picking up a few grains of sand on the beach. It's the sum and substance of modern science. It's no different now than it was 100 or 200 years when he spoke, because Albert Einstein said the same thing much more recently. He said, we have just picked up one or two grains of sand from the... We have not even gone to the ocean. He said, I consider God and the spiritual dimension the real object of knowledge, the real purpose that we're here, and we have not even got off the beach. And not only that, we have only picked up one or two grains of sand. We're not even in the water yet. And why is that? Because they didn't have advantage of the parampara, the disciplics, relying on imperfect senses. So how can we understand the Supreme Person? You see Lord Vishnu lying down here as he exhales from his breathing and from the pores of his skin. Millions and millions and millions of unlimited universes are emanating. So how can we understand that source of our creation? We're, after the fact, in one of those planets, which is in one of those universes, which is among millions and millions of universes, which Lord Vishnu created long before we came to consciousness. How are we going to understand? By direct perception. How are we going to understand? By inference or induction. There's only one way we can understand, is to receive the knowledge directly from the Lord Himself as it's passed down through the ages in disciplic succession. And I'll give you an example to finish here. Let's say your father impregnated your mother and then left. So you were born and you grew up. Your father never came back. You've never seen him. After some time, a man walks through your door, says, I'm your dad. How are you going to verify? How are you going to know without doubt that that man is telling the truth? How do you know that this man is not a liar, a charlatan, a cheat? Is there any way that you can determine that without a doubt? You can look at him all you want and it will not dispel doubt. You can touch him or taste him or smell him all you want and you'll still not be able to be without doubt. There is a way. And it's beyond your ability to experience. You have to rely on the experience of someone else. Who is that? Exactly. You have to rely on the experience of your mom. And you say, "Mom, is this my dad?" And then whatever she says, you can take that without a doubt. So who is that gigantic, all-powerful personality from whose body millions and millions and millions of universes are coming, originally like little golden eggs? How can we know by experience who that person is? We can't. But we can know by the mechanism that that person has himself put into place, the chain of disciplic succession. That when your mother tells you who your father is, you can know without doubt. So who is the mother in this case? The mother are the words of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And those words are known by those of us in the Indian culture as the Vedas. And the sum and substance, the crest jewel of all the Vedas is called the Bhagavad Gita, or the Song of God. And in the Song of God, Krishna says, Mata parataram nanyat kinchid janastin jananjaya. He says, Mata parataram nanyat. Mata, again, the first person singular, me, and he's standing on the chariot 5,000 years ago in front of Arjuna, and again he's saying, me, parataram. Para means above. So Krishna says to Arjuna, Mata parataram, then me above nanya. Nothing. There is nothing higher than me. That I am standing before my devotee, attracted by the loving attitude of my devotee, exerting my power to dispel his doubt and to help him out and to help out all those souls in future generations who will be fortunate enough to understand the Bhagavad Gita through the parampara and from pure devotees, in this way, the understanding is available for those who are fortunate enough to be able to take advantage of it. And it's not that we can know by our own powers, but Bhaktisiddhanta, Prabhupada's guru, once said, the infinitesimal can never know the infinite. If we're infinitesimal, God's infinite. It's like trying to explain to an ant the internet. How is it possible? So we're infinitesimal, and we haven't got the power to understand the infinite. We haven't got the power. However, the infinite has the power to reveal himself to the infinitesimal. And he has the power to reveal himself in such a way as to completely leave no room for doubt. So we start with doubts. That's good. That's a sign of intelligence. But we want to get rid of them. They represent darkness, confusion, and suffering. We want to move immediately to get rid of them. And the methodology for that is to approach the highest authority and get the unequivocal, timeless answers to the questions of who we are, why we've been put here, what is the purpose of life, and are we going back home, back to the spiritual world at the end of it? We'll stop there.